भद्रं कर्णे विश्वमयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवकिदं जदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। सो वी आर कंटिन्यूइंग अ डिस्कशन वेयर वी लेफ्ट इन द लास्ट सेशन। So in the last class, we dealt with the second mantra of the Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad. The Upanishad says, Svayam Atma Chadushpad. This Atman, this Self, is possessed of four quarters. And we already found that it indicates that the experiences of waking state will merge with the dream state, and the experiences of dream state and waking state both together merge in deep sleep or dreamless sleep state. So there is an ascending order of mergence, I mean coming together, unification. Now this idea is very important. And this Atman, which is possessed of four quarters, is called Tiriya in the Mandukya tradition. Now, in spiritual life and also in spiritual philosophy, there is an evolution on the part of the spiritual seeker and also an evolution with regard to our concept of God or Absolute Reality. As we evolve in our spiritual life, our idea of God, our idea of the Absolute Reality also grows and evolves. This is a very important point to remember. For example, a most primitive person may think of his God or her God more or less along his own lines. It is true that God made man in his own image, but it's more accurate to say that man makes God in his own image. This seems to be much more accurate from the standpoint of spiritual life. Our idea of God is in a way creation of our own spiritual culture. Just as yesterday, you know, Swami, in the lecture with Swami, which was read from Complete Works, the world we see is in a way creation of our own mind. So also, God is not our creation, but our idea of God is our creation. Which means, as we evolve in spiritual life, our concept of the Absolute Reality also evolves. There is an interesting dialogue in the Bhagavad Purana, which is a very famous dialogue. A dialogue between a great philosopher king called Nimi and nine sages. It comes in the 11th skandha, 11th book of the Bhagavata, the great classic, second chapter. It's very interesting. In ancient times, you know, sages used to go about visiting places. Frequently they will visit kings in their palaces. They used to assemble on the banks of Ganga and they used to hold discussions on spiritual topics. So nine sages happened to visit a king. The text says, Kavir Harir Andariksha Prabuddhak Pippalayana Avi Khotroda Samasakara Bhajanaka. So, nine sages. So, Kavir Harir Andariksha Prabuddhak Pippalayana Avi Khotroda Dumila Samasakara Bhajanaka. These are nine sages. They came to a king, and the king puts nine questions, and each of the sages, nine sages, gives an answer. One important question that the king put to these sages was this. That's about the evolution of the spiritual seeker's concept of God. And one verse says, Sarvabhudeshu yat pasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavadottamaha. The dearest man or dearest spiritual seeker to God or the most highly evolved person is he or she who can see the presence of God everywhere and who can see everything in God. Now, this may raise many questions, you know. Is it really possible? Can we see a God in a Hitler or Mussolini? People may ask this question. I've been asked these questions. It's a very interesting question. Well, Sri Ramakrishna gives the answer. You can see God in a tiger, but you don't go near and befriend it. You see it from a distance because the God himself, the God's power has taken the image of a cruel, monstrous animal. But in between the animal, there is the presence of the divine. It is not started manifesting, that's all. So that's the only point. So the highest spiritual person is one who may see this divine presence behind the diversity. But those who have not reached that stage, they should be very careful during the spiritual practices, during the sadhana stage, when they are still evolving. They should not assume that they have reached the highest peak of evolution. They should realize where they stand. So you should be careful about how you interact with people. You should associate with people whose company will help you in spiritual life and keep a long distance away from those whose company may disturb your faith or your spiritual practice. There are people whose association may pour cold water on whatever you hold to be sacred and spiritual. Right. It's very important. And you return as a skeptic and a doubter of everything. So that is a very dangerous situation. Unless you became a Buddha, you should not confront an Ajamila. You know the story. Ajamila was the name of a monster. And he had a wonderful hobby. The hobby was, he used to kill people and cut off their fingers and make a garland and put it on his neck. That was his hobby. And Buddha was walking through a forest. So people warned him, here is a monster living in the forest, be careful. Buddha said, it's okay. And he went ahead. This monster, the evil man, followed Buddha. Buddha didn't react. He could not catch up with Buddha. He went on running, but Buddha was walking slowly. He could not catch up. Finally, Buddha turned back. And then this man became different because this Ajamila was really a spiritual seeker. He had done a terrible injury, terrible harm to some spirit, some sages in his life. So he got this evil samskaras and vasanas. So he became an evil person. And finally he apologized to the sage. And the sage told him, well, when you happen to meet Tathagata means Buddha, then you will become liberated. So this happened and Buddha looked back and looked at his face and Ajamila got back his previous memories. But unless you became a Buddha, don't confront Ajamilas. You will only lose your fingers and life also. So the great sage Antariksha says, there are people whose association could disturb your spiritual life. Keep a long distance. Don't befriend them, that is dangerous, obviously. Don't antagonize them, because that also will bring you into connect, it will connect you with him. Both are equally harmful. So, now the question arises, what about this evolution? So, in spiritual life, in our life, there is a gradual evolution in our own understanding of God and the absolute reality. In fact, our own concept of higher values, what supreme value we keep as something sacred for us to attain, that in a way reveals where we stand. What are the supreme values that we consider to be dear and near to us, which we consider to be important, which we want to realize, and which we consider to be our goal to achieve? So in spiritual life, there is an evolution from religion to spirituality, from idea of God or a concept of God into God as an experience, from many to one, from gross to subtle, and in the classical religious philosophy, they talk about six stages: pantheism, panentheism, polytheism, monotheism, henotheism, and monism. These are the six stages. So pantheism is one stage. Pantheism can also can be a supreme ideal as great as monism. Well, maybe the some of the examples we can find pantheism as a great spiritual ideal. Emerson was a pantheist. Whitman was a pantheist. Thoreau was a pantheist. If you read the poem, you know, Brahma, you find some of the verses in the Gita are almost repeated verbatim. In fact, I gave one or two lectures on Sunday lectures on this Emerson. So he's a pantheist. If you can see God's presence in the beauty and grandeur or mystery of nature, then a beautiful flower, a river, or valley, or a lake will take your mind all the way to God. So, it's possible. Pantheism implies equating nature to God. Secondly, panentheism, where it's a little more subtle, where you think of an inherent, immanent spirit present in all natural phenomena. More or less, you find this in Shinto religion of the ancient Japanese tradition. But they believe in the presence of a spirit, maybe in some of the religious ideas of Native Americans, you find the earth spirit present everywhere. The third stage is polytheism, where you feel the presence of God operating behind all natural phenomena. There's a God behind ocean, behind clouds, behind rains, behind air. So you find in the Vedic literature, for example, Agni is a deification of the principle of fire. Or Varuna, the god of ocean, clouds, then air, Marut, or Vayu, the sunlight, Soma. You find many such, you find in the Vedic literature, this pantheism and also polytheism, where you visualize, posit a divine reality operating behind all natural phenomena. And there is another system called monotheism, where you consider one deity as supreme. The most classical examples are the three Abrahamic religions and also the Vaishnava, Shakta, Saiva, and these traditions of popular Hinduism. It's called monotheism. Henotheism is not a religious concept. It is a way of interpreting some of the Vedic suktas, which was in a way a contribution of Professor Max Muller, who wrote an elaborate introduction to Rigveda Samhita, which he published. So he says henotheism is nothing but in one Rigveda mantra, for example, addressed to Indra, Indra is looked upon as the supreme god. In that mantra, but another mantra is some other, maybe Soma, Pavamana, and others will take the place. It's called called henotheism. And the highest one is monism, where you think of the absolute reality as beyond name and form, as beyond qualities, as beyond verbalization, beyond definitions, beyond descriptions. Now, where does this become relevant? Where do we think of the absolute reality as beyond name and form? The question arises, if you interpret God as the sum total of all that is good in the world, let us say God is the best friend, most powerful, most generous, and very wonderful person, then the question arises, What about the evil? How do you explain the presence of evil? It's a big question, in fact. This is a question that actually all the radical humanists and even modern agnostics and atheists, whether Professor Dr. Richard means Richard, there's a the one God, the God illusion, you know, the one who wrote, he was a professor of Cambridge. This is maybe the most celebrated agnostic or atheist.
Stephen Hawking.
Eh?
Stephen Hawking.
No.
Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, he's the one. He was the selfish gene, all the famous books. That's the main question. They're all wonderful people, good humanists. Much better than many God-fearing people in reality. Much better human beings than many traditional, conventional believers in God who create more problems for God and also for human beings. In fact, Richard Dawkins, his question is, if you think of God as somebody who lives in heaven, of course with a big stick in his hand, say, promising heaven to those who endorse his existence, believe in him, and threatening with eternal damnation those who do not believe in him, dividing mankind into believers and non-believers, those who are fit for going to heaven and those who are not, those don't make the grade to go to heaven. What do you think of that? So the question arises, we should find a logical explanation. And you find two classical examples, one in the Upanishads, and maybe the only parallel example is Meister Eckhart, who talked about via negativa. Well, he used paradoxical terms to explain one supreme reality that's above our traditional, conventional, theological definitions of God as a compassionate person. So only such an interpretation of God will accommodate the reality, the undeniable reality of evil in this world. It's not that God is impartial or God is neutral, God doesn't support the good, not at all. But at the ontological level, at the logical level, you should find an explanation for the possibility of the negative forces. So conventional, the received Christian theology solves this problem very easily. There's a devil. He's also there. So God and devil. Devil also is trying to bribe, to catch hold of souls, taking them away from the track leading to God. And God, in his compassion, he has come into the world and he pays with the sins of mankind through crucifixion. The historical Jesus becomes the universal Jesus. So this is a very wonderful, very wonderful solution to the problem. And you find such solutions in popular Hinduism, in monotheistic Hinduism, in all non-Advaitic, non-dualistic religions of Hinduism, Vedanta, you find this. Now, here the question arises, if you think of God as the one who transcends attributes and qualities, not devoid of qualities and attributes, that should be remembered. The word gunatita is a Sanskrit word. Gunatita or nirguna, both are used. So, the nir prefix upasarga has got one meaning, that is it rejects the possibility of gunas, the other it transcends it. Gunatita means going beyond qualities. Because when you talk about qualities like compassion, it has got a logical meaning only in the context of its opposite. If you are a strong man, which means there is somebody who is not strong. If it is a black flower, there is a white flower. So it's like two sides of the same coin. So attributelessness doesn't mean being devoid of attributes, but going beyond attributes, going beyond the possibility of interpreting the absolute reality within the framework of attributes and qualities. So that is what's called negative theology in the language of Meister Eckhart. So he used these terms, or he uses metaphors and paradoxical expressions. God, he didn't say that God is devoid of attributes and qualities, and the Franciscans tried to persecute him. Of course, he disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. But anyway, he was a great Dominican. So what happened, you know, his interpretation of the Supreme Godhead, the ultimate being, as something that transcends verbalization, was misunderstood to be a kind of sacrilege and blasphemy. That means God transcends all attributes and qualities. Language cannot express God, the absolute reality. God is beyond any kind of definitions. So the language used is kind of a combination of opposite meanings, mean paradoxical expressions. That's what we are coming to now in the Mandukya Upanishad. The seventh mantra is a supreme example of negative theology. That means, so in simple principle, this is very simple to understand. The idea that absolute reality is beyond attributes, good and bad. You may ask the question, what is the logic for it? The logic is very simple. When you use the word good and bad, cruel and compassionate, all these words, you can relate only to empirical things, not to absolute things. Because everything that is good can be understood only in the context of certain things which are not good. He is a tall man only when he is accompanied by shorter persons. Another person, taller person comes, he is short, he becomes short. So everything is relative. So any kind of verbalization, this verbalization is an English word that is frequently used to express one particular method of analysis in Vedanta. I shall try to explain that. Anything that is beyond verbalization, beyond definition, beyond expression, explanation, cannot be expressed in terms of good and bad, because these two words, good and bad, relate to things of this world, only to empirical phenomena. And if you are talking about God, that is the absolute reality, formless, again formless, doesn't mean devoid of forms, beyond form or transcending form. So very often, this should be understood very clearly. Vedantic texts are not easy to understand unless you learn it from a teacher who has learned from his teacher and who has learned from his teacher. There is a succession. It is as terrible as learning swimming or music through correspondence course, as learning through Vedanta by our own effort. Anyway, I shall just try to explain this. So, nameless means transcending names. What's the meaning of transcending names? It means transcending the possibility of definition or description in words, that speaks. Beyond attributes, guna atita, nirguna. What does it mean? It only means transcending the realm of definition or description or explanation in terms of qualities or attributes. That's what it means. So, that's why it's beyond verbalization. In Vedantic terminology, it is called Pancha Sabda Pravritti. It means five types of verbalization. Five methods of expressing anything at empirical level. You can express something in terms of jadi or genetic category, species. He's an animal. That means he is not a stone or a tree or human being. He's an animal. The other one is guna. That means quality, attributes. Red flower, white flower, and so on. Karma, as you mentioned, you know, he's a singer, which means he's a person whose profession is music. Or maybe sambandha means relationship. If you explain he is somebody's sister, or she is somebody's sister, or he is somebody's brother, father, mother, and relationship. Dravya means what is, well, that is quite obvious. Well, if you say, it's just like sun. Nobody will ask you the question, what is sun? Nobody will ask. So it's so well obvious. These are five possibilities of expressing things in words and in sentences. So the absolute reality is beyond these five types of verbalization, which is Panja Shabda Pravritti Nishedha. Negation of the possibility of interpretation or description or definition in terms of these five conditions, that is what is what we are going to discuss. And that is exactly what Eckhart tried to do but did not succeed, because Eckhart tradition or religious culture in the landscape where he worked and functioned did not have the vocabulary to understand this negative theology of what I call Vaya Negativa. So that's the mantra, seventh mantra. Those who have got the text can see the text. It is this, na anta prajnam na bahish prajnam. So na means, you know, no, not. Na anta prajnam na bahish prajnam na ubhayada prajnam na prajnanaghanam na prajnam na aprajnam. Adhishtam avyavaharyam agrahyam alakshanam achindyam avyapadesyam Egatma Pratyasaram, Prapanjopashamam, Shantam, Shivam, Advaitam, Chadurtham, Manyande, Saatma, Savigneha. This is the mantra. Supposed to be one of the most famous statements in entire Vedic literature. It's a description of Turiya that we already explained in the earlier mantra. Chadushpad, Swayamatma, Chadushpad. So this Atman, this fourth state which transcends all other states, it is to be understood as that which is not conscious of the internal world, not conscious of the external world. See, na anta prajnam na bahish prajnam. This should be understood, because that which is conscious of the external world is waking state. That which is conscious of the internal world is supma state or dream state. So, in waking state, our mind and the five senses experience things at the gross level. In waking state, our mind is involved, but without the involvement of the five senses of perception, the mind itself cannot see objects. In dream, we see the trees and mountains and valleys. In dream, the senses of perception are not directly involved, but without some connection with an experience in which senses of perception are involved, you cannot have a dream, because the dream gets its food, its raw material, from waking state. As I mentioned yesterday, you can never have a dream which is completely cut off from waking state experience. So this fourth state of Turiya is totally different from the waking state and totally different from the dream state. It is totally different from the experiencer of the waking state, and it is totally different from the experiencer of the dream state. So I mentioned right now, you cannot have a dream without some connection of the dream objects with the waking state experiences. In the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you read some young spiritual seekers came to him and they talked about the dreams that they had, some spiritually elevating dreams. And Sri Ramakrishna was very happy. You know why he was happy? Their dreams revealed the fact that they were always thinking of higher spiritual ideas, the waking state. Unless you accumulate vasanas and samskaras, impressions and memories from your waking state, you cannot re-experience, relive higher dreams. You cannot have higher dream states. So, Sri Ramakrishna was happy because these spiritual seekers were doing a lot of spiritual practices in the waking state. So, this fourth state, Turiya state, that is the state of Atman, is neither the experiencer of the waking state or the experiencer of the dream state. And it is not conscious of both, neither the presence nor the absence, that is what it means. And then it is dense with consciousness, prajnana ghanam, so the word is used, prajnana ghanam. It is neither waking state nor dream state, nor a combination of both, nor the absence of either. So what you will do? Either you go crazy or you become spiritually the most elevated person if you read. So what does it mean? How do you tell a person you cannot explain this? Then you exhaust all possibilities of explanation, and then you show the fact none of these explanations could fully explain what you are trying to explain. Then you will understand it is beyond explanation. Even because in the original Shankaracharya's commentary, Shankaracharya was the one who wrote commentary on this. One objector, you know, the Shankara's commentaries are in the form of dialogues. Opposite views, objections are raised by different philosophical schools, Mimamsa. And the four schools of Buddhism, you know, Vijnanavada, Shunyavada, Sautrantika, and Vaibhashikas, they are very prominent in the Mandukya Garika system because Gaudapada has accommodated all their arguments and Shankaracharya has also elaborately written commentaries on all this. So a number of objections are raised. So one objection is, then is it zero? You see, neither this nor that, nor is opposite, nor the combination of. Then zero, the Shunyavadis, you know, Nagarjuna school. According to Nagarjuna, the highest supreme reality is one total voidness. But from total emptiness, you cannot imagine even this relative empirical world coming into existence. If the relative world comes into existence from something, that something which is caused cannot be emptiness. Because the world is not empty. So how can something come out of nothing? So anyway, so what it means is, it is beyond description, beyond words, beyond explanation. But then the question arises, why conscious, unconscious, these words are used? It is neither consciousness at the internal level, nor consciousness at the external level. Neither waking state, nor dream state, etc. The answer is, all these explanations, whatever words you use, all belong to the empirical. So, words, language, descriptions, and definitions belong to the relative plane. In the absolute plane, there are no words. The absolute can only be experienced, can never be explained. So what is the language of the absolute? Silence is the language of the absolute. So one of our Vedic statements is there, which relates to this. Antaya bhuvadinam anantaya mokam. The absolute can only be expressed through the language of silence, which is not language at all, beyond words. That's why a negative of the most supreme example. The relative can be explained in words, because when you express in words, you have to use good, but you also to use bad. If a flower is red, then there are other flowers which are not red. You have to say red, white or yellow or whatever it is. If you are talking about God as the sum total of all good qualities, always kind, always generous. So people ask this question, then why can't God give insurance, Medicare to all the people in the world? Why should there be misery in the life of human beings? Why should there be tsunamis, earthquakes, tragedies and so on? The point is, the absolute reality is beyond good and bad, beyond good and evil, beyond all these relative definitions. So Eckhart tried to project a concept of reality that goes beyond the Trinity. That was the daring attempt he made, of course, for which he had to pay with his life, if we can believe some of the legends associated with his disappearance. So we are coming to the subject again. Then say, Adushtam Avyavaharyam Agrahim Alakshanam Achintyam, etc. Now, this reality, it cannot be seen, it is not visible, it is unseen. What does it mean? You cannot understand or objectify or know about it with your eyes and mind. Eye seeing means mind and eyes coming together, you see that. So, and actionless, it means it is silent. In fact, one of our own India's great thinkers, Aravindo, made one of the most, I would call it, disastrous statements. He took many things from Shankara's philosophy. Then Shankara's Brahman is inactive like a stone. So that's one of the main statements he made. It is quoted very often to reveal something about Aravindo, which is not very compliment, not much of a compliment. Anyway, I'm trying to focus on this idea. That's why I draw this attention. Okay. So it is Avyavaharyam. Avyavaharyam means actionless. Does it mean that Brahman or Atman, Turiya, is inactive? Atman itself is beyond action and also beyond inaction. So action-inaction equation applies only to the relative level. Action means something that happens when mind and the senses of action and also senses of perception are involved. It's called action. And action implies relativity. Action implies imperfection. You go on doing something because you want to achieve something through action. And if you want to achieve something, you are imperfect. You are wanting in something. That's why you are trying to achieve something. So, the point is, here, it means Atman or Turiya transcends action and inaction both. That's an important point to remember. That is Avyavaharyam. But we are able to function, we are able to think, we are able to do things only because there is Atman within us. But Atman is not the doer. Atman itself is not the doer, but without Atman's presence, we cannot walk, we cannot talk, we cannot think, we can't feel happy or unhappy. So at any level, at the level of the senses of perception, senses of action, senses of vital urge, prana, or mind or emotions or intellect, we cannot do anything without the presence of Atman within us. But Atman itself is not directly involved in all this. Atman is the witness. Atman is present. The reason is, if Atman is said to be involved in something, as I mentioned, then Atman becomes a doer. Anything which is engaged in any action indicates that it is not perfect. So the meaning is Brahman is beyond action and beyond also beyond inaction. Gita says karmanya karmaye pasyet akarmani cha karmayeka sa buddhiman manishyesu sa yukta krishna karma kuta. The highest and wisest spiritual person is one who can see action in inaction and also inaction in action. We are always, we may be active 24 hours of the day. But that's why the great mystics, great thinkers like Shankara, Vivekananda, Jesus, Buddha, all these great men and women, they did a lot of work, great mystics and spiritual teachers. But they were not really tired in the sense that we get tired. Because if you are a devotee of God, you think God is making me do all this. So there also you come is a kind of disclaimer. God is the doer. I have no role in this. God makes me do all this. I am an instrument in God's hands. If you are a philosopher of devotional tradition, if you are a jnani, if you are a philosopher, then you would say, I am the true I goes beyond the psychophysical mechanism. The true I is Atman. That Atman is present in me. But who is acting? My senses, my mind may be involved, but my true nature is not senses or mind, but I am Atman. So that is why it is said, Indriyan Indriyartheshu Vartante Idi Dharayan. This is how a great spiritual seeker who looks upon himself as Atman thinks of himself. He does all these things, but he is not affected. So, does it mean inaction or negligence? We may do things at a empirical level. We have to be active. Shankaracharya was active, Vivekananda was active, Sri Ramakrishna was active. He was preaching and advising spiritual seekers even to the last days of his life. He could have retired. He didn't do. So, you may ask the question, he was so active, like a CEO or a professional business management specialist? No. He was doing all that and he said, the mother is doing all this. Mother is making me into all this. So, a total disclaimer. Or, I am the Atman. So, Atman is present. Atman is not directly involved in action. So, Atman is not directly involved in inaction either. Atman is not involved in inaction. Atman, because in you can practice inaction only if there is a possibility of your practicing action. Inaction is nothing but withdrawal or absence of action. And this absence of action is conceivable only if you can think of actions. So, you should be a rich man first to give up all your money. A pauper cannot give up all his money. He should work hard, make money, then he should give up. So, action, inaction, both are applicable at the empirical level. Atman Turiya transcends both. So, avyavahariyam. So, that should be understood very clearly. Because the translation may state, oh, actionless. So, it should be understood. It means transcending the idea of action, inaction equation. Or action, inaction conundrum. That's how you should understand this. So, adrishtam, it is not seen. Does it mean the Atman is not to be seen anywhere? Atman is not seen. It doesn't mean Atman is the only reality. Anything that you see is not absolutely real. So, anything that the senses perceive is a foolproof that it is not there. It is the opposite of our normal experience. When we see something, it is there. And when we don't see something, we say it is not there. But Vedanta tells you, if you see something, it means you are seeing something at empirical level, with the mind and sense of sight put together, and anything at empirical level will not be there after some time. This lake won't be there maybe after 1 billion years, or be several billions of years. It is there today, but it won't be there after some billions of years. So you are seeing with your mind and sight. But Atman you don't see because it will be always there. It transcends sensory perception. So that's the meaning of Adrishtam, unseen or invisible. Agrahyam. So agrahyam means something incomprehensible. That's all clear. Comprehension means objectification. So comprehension is objectified knowledge, which means we are the subjects and what we comprehend is the object. And we use different tools for this comprehension. We use the five senses or we use the mind. That kind of comprehension is fine, but it works only at the empirical plane. And if you comprehend something, it's a sure proof it won't be there in future. There is a possibility of not being there, maybe after some billions of years. It is non-eternal, it is non-immortal. So that's the meaning of incomprehensible, agrahyam, alakshanam. Alakshanam means, lakshana is some sign, external proof. See, the classical example in Indian epistemology is called anumana, inference. Anumana is understood in Aristotelian logic also. Anumana is inference. See, in classical Indian logic, if you see smoke in a mountain, it shows that there is a fire somewhere, raging fire. So, through the presence, by understanding smoke that you see at a distance, you infer, it's called anumana, you infer the possibility of fire. So, Atman cannot be understood through any of the six tools of knowledge. So, Vedanta accepts six tools of knowledge. Indian epistemology is very profound. Right from 1 to 10. It is a very interesting subject, Indian epistemology. It's a very comprehensive subject. Very often these are not studied even in universities in its full scale. See, materialists, Charvakas, they believe only one epistemological tool, the direct perception. They don't believe in inference or comparison or analogy. They don't believe. Only one is called pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means, aksha means eyes. That which is within the realm of the eyes, which means any of the five senses like the eye. So pratyaksha means anything that is subjected to sensory perception. So Indian materialists believe only in one. But Indian mythological philosophers believe in 10 schools, 10 tools of epistemology, the most elaborate. Of course, it is a far-fetched version of Indian epistemology. Vedanta accepts 6 tools of knowledge. That is, direct perception, pratyaksha, anumana or inference, then upamana is comparison, then shabda is verbal testimony.
What is that?
First one is pratyaksha, direct perception, in which mind and senses are involved. Inference is, as I mentioned, inference, you know, it is in Greek logic, it's all well known. The inference. The other one is analogy or comparison. So you try to explain or understand something by comparing it something that you already know. In fact, all teachers use, you know, relating what the student knows already to what you are going to teach him now. So it's in a way some kind of a comparison. The fourth one is shabda, means verbal testimony, which Christian, mainstream theology accepts, you know, the theological works. Not only the Bible, but also the Augustinian and Aquinas, all these theological books. So Augustine has already explained at length the Christian epistemology, which Aquinas followed. So there's a fourth one, verbal testimony. The fifth one is, you know, presumption, arthapatti, where something you cannot really explain through inference, you try to explain in a way which is really not different from inference. He said, is another version, a refined form of inference. See, a person tells you, I don't eat food at all. I'm very acidic, but he's 300 pounds and suffering from diabetes and digestion problems. That means he says, I don't eat anything during that time, which means he's eating 4 square meals at night. It's a classical example. And this is a classical example. The person's name is Devadatta. So I don't eat anything during that time. This is classic. You know, all these Pramana Shastra, they're classical examples. So they use the same analogy, like the rope snake analogy. You know, so it means Divamna Bhukte, I don't eat. Devadatta is a name. A person tells you, I don't eat anything during their time, but is fat and growing fatter and fatter. It means he eats at night.
Yes.
So it is a refined form of inference. But it is not inference the way you infer the possibility of fire in the mountain by seeing the smoke. So it is not direct inference, some kind of something related to that. And another one is very important, that is the absence or the negation. See, when you come to know that something doesn't exist, that itself is a proof of its impossibility, which is not accepted in Aristotelian logic, of course. So these are the 6 tools of epistemology in Indian logic or Indian wisdom. That means pratyaksha, anumana, vamana, sabda, arthapatti, anupalabdhi. That means something is not available, it is negated, it's not there. So even the absence of something is some kind of an information. It's a confirmation. That's idea. Of course, stretching beyond that, people who believe in different cults and different subcults like Shakta, Shaiva, Vaishnava, they stretch their epistemology up to 8 and also even up to 10. So Cheshta is one, you know, Cheshta, well, the classical example of Cheshta is Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The process of induction, deduction. You exclude certain things. So the classical example is, suppose in a classroom, somebody had kept a huge box on a high shelf, and there is, all people are below 5 feet. One fellow, 6 feet, and this mischievous look about him, and you ask everyone, they say, I didn't do. And the last fellow, the 6 feet fellow, has a mischievous smile about him, Cheshta. So you come to the conclusion, he's the culprit who has kept this huge box on the shelf. This is an example given in the classical books. I'm reproducing this, it's not my copyright, the ancient writer's copyright. So it's called exclusion, the law of exclusion. Exclude middleness. Anyway, we need not go to that extent. The whole problem, the whole point here to be understood is that something that's beyond comprehension means something that is beyond any kind of understanding, any kind of inference. The word used here is, you know, alakshanam. So that should be understood. Alakshanam, lakshana is an external sign. The smoke in the mountain is a lakshana, is an external sign. So from there you come to the conclusion there is fire. So through one word, it is beyond inference. The Upanishad tells you it is beyond all other epistemological tools as well. It is called Upalakshana Nyaya. Means Upalakshana means one word is used. For example, it cannot be seen. A statement, to give an example. It cannot be seen. You know what it means, actually? It means it cannot be perceived through the eyesight. It cannot be heard through the ears. It cannot be tasted. It cannot, like that, it cannot be smelled. So if one is used, one of the five senses is referred to, it refers to all other four senses also. So beyond inference, that's the meaning of this particular word, alakshanam, means it doesn't have an external sign by which you understand it through inference. It means it is beyond inference, beyond direct perception, beyond analogy, that is comparison, beyond verbal testimony, beyond presumption, and beyond negation. That's what it means. It is beyond all epistemological tools. It means it's called sarva pramana avati, means it is beyond the whole range of tools of knowledge, epistemological knowledge. That's what it means. So you can imagine the Shunyavadins, Nagarjuna's followers, they objected. You say this Atman cannot be seen, and you cannot be inferred, it cannot be comprehended, and then what is it? It's a zero, big zero. So it is of Shunya, nothing else, they say. Shankaracharya says, it doesn't mean it is devoid of all this. It means it beyond all this. So that should be understood. Vedanta says, it transcends everything. Shunyavadins or Nagarjuna school negates things. Shankaracharya says, it's not negation, it is transcendence. That's exactly, and you know why, the reason why I refer to Eckhart. Of course, before Eckhart also, some Dionysius, some other thinkers also, it is you find references that they also use negative theology. But the most marvelous parallel that you find in Christian theological, philosophical tradition is Eckhart's own Via Negativa, where he used paradoxical expressions to explain what is beyond explanation, to define what is beyond definition, something that goes beyond the Trinity, Holy Trinity of the Church. That's what I'm referring to. So, okay. So, I think we have taken enough time, so we'll have interaction. So we'll continue the discussion tomorrow. Thank you. We can have interaction. So.
This lecture is so hard to understand everything. Okay, so if I understand Atman, so I, with my ear, eyes, feelings, I won't understand Atman. How I know my Atman?
Yeah, so the Upanishad doesn't tell you that everyone should follow this path. You will reach this ideal maybe after some time. So we should always remember where we stand. A Vedanta doesn't tell you that the same ideal is applicable to all. The very fact that you feel a bit difficult even to intellectually comprehend, it means you are a devotee. So you should read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna himself tells, Brahman is anuchishta. Brahman has never been explained. Brahman is beyond definition. Brahman is beyond explanation. Sri Ramakrishna himself says. But Sri Ramakrishna also tells you that you can pray to God, you can pray to Divine Mother. That is also one path. So, we should remember, the Upanishad presents before you a very high ideal. There is always this problem that we assume that we are fit for the highest. So that's where I have to often say a few things, you know. There is this concept of fitness. Fitness doesn't mean that you are inferior or superior. So very often people ask me this question. If Buddha could understand, why can't I? If Jesus Christ, what's the difference between me and Jesus? After all, he'll like to be honored like Jesus, but not be crucified like him. It's not a very happy experience. Is he willing to sacrifice like that for humanity? So we should remember, the highest philosophy, we may not be the right path for us, but it helps you in a very big way. The idea that God is beyond definition, God is beyond explanation, God is the supreme reality, it helps us, it takes us, and it prevents us from becoming a fanatic. The most important contribution of Upanishad, at the very, very empirical plane, it makes us noble human beings. It helps us to save ourselves from the trap of hatred, from bitterness, from all the maladies of emotions and mind. That's what really caught on me. When Swamiji came, when what he spoke in the Parliament of Religion, he would have talked about Sri Ramakrishna as a great devotee. He would have presented many things. He presented most universal spiritual idea. It doesn't mean that everyone should follow or fit to follow that. But if we can keep in our mind this high ideal, it broadens our vision and it saves us from fanaticism, from narrow-mindedness and from many other evils. Because remember, religious devotion, as we understand it, has created a lot of problems. A classic example is, of course, I'm not blaming anybody. Russian Orthodox Church produced the largest number of mystics in Christian world. You look at the Philokalia, look at so many masters to the Orthodox Church. The whole of Europe, the rest of Europe didn't produce maybe not even half as many as the Russian Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox put together. But so extreme devotion, extreme asceticism on the one hand, we produce some great geniuses, but often it can produce fanaticism, rigidity. So what Vivekananda mentioned was this Upanishadic philosophy, Vedantic philosophy, gives a very transcendental, very universal spiritual ideal before us. It doesn't mean that we should immediately accept it or we can't say I would either join Stanford or I would remain illiterate. We don't do that. You don't do that. You have to join where we are fit to join, then only we can continue our education from where we have reached right now. That's it. I hope it's clear.
Yeah.
I know it's not a very satisfactory thing to be told that this is the highest philosophy, but you are not fit for it. It is not a very pleasant experience. But, you know, Sri Ramakrishna said, the highest Vedanta should be kept in our mind as an idea. See, for example, let us say we have our own Krishna, Rama, Ramakrishna, and we are devoted to that. This devotion can sometimes lead to narrow-mindedness, which was the opposite of what Sri Ramakrishna taught. It's the very opposite of what Sri Ramakrishna taught. Upanishadic philosophy teaches us to go beyond. That by Sri Ramakrishna is described Veda Murti. Veda means Upanishadic knowledge, Upanishadic philosophy. Sri Ramakrishna is the embodiment of Upanishadic wisdom or Upanishadic truth. That's what we understand. Okay. Yeah.
Swami, could you translate that prayer that you said at the beginning? You know, when you said a prayer at the beginning.
Tomorrow I can do that. I can give a detailed exposition.
Oh, okay. Thank
because
you.
Today the question answer. Yeah.
Or just the words.
No, I can give a complete complete interpretation.
Okay.
Today also I can do, but then, you know,
maybe
this is question answer, so many people may be interested in asking questions.
Right.
So
thank you.
Tomorrow, please. I shall
certainly. Thank you.
Yeah. Even if I forget, you can remind me.
Okay.
Beginning itself.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maharaj, you said for the dream state, the raw material is the waking state.
Dream state?
For the dream state, to get dreams, the raw material for the dream is the experience in the waking state.
Yeah.
Now, Drishti Srishti Vada says that what you see is what's inside you.
Yeah.
The projection, the projected world is already inside you.
So, Drishti Srishti Vada also tells you that, you know, you interpret the world, your experience, according to your own mental world, mental vasanas and vrittis. These vasanas and vrittis are nothing but subtle forms, residual subtle forms of experiences that you already had in the past, which have become part of a character. So, our mind is nothing but the sum total of all the memories and impressions that we have gathered, either in this life or also in the previous life. So accordingly, we look at the world and we interpret the world. We define the world. So that is true. So that's what it means. Now, let us say dream. In waking state, we have experienced, we have interpreted our own experiences and also the external world. With our mind, we have interpreted the external world, our own experiences, with our mind, using our mind as an instrument. This also will produce vasanas and vrittis, which again enrich, which again contribute, which are added to the already accumulated impressions and vrittis. With that, we dream. So, that's why a dream can also contain vasanas and impressions, not only from this life, but also from previous life.
Yeah.
The antakarana is a reservoir in which all these are accumulated. Our total character is nothing but the function of antakarana. Antakarana means our impressions, vrittis, vasanas, all. That's why people find difficult to practice spiritual sadhanas. One possible reason for conflict is, you know, negative impressions, vasanas and tendencies that are already accumulated create a stumbling block, a mental block, whenever we try to do something noble. So, people who are very sincere, at times, when we read the book, oh, wonderful. When we read, when we are in the temple or a church or a synagogue, when we meditate, it's wonderful. And we come out of it, and we try to do something, immediately something else catches hold. No, don't do that. Who is doing that? We should remember it is not it's not lack of sincerity. You find people who are very sincere, very honest, really focused, suffering from serious problems, sometimes getting a root awakening, you know, fate catching you by the throat through tragic events, setbacks, terrible things in domestic life, tragedies. All these may suddenly catch us by the throat and we open the eyes and we, well, these Upanishads are wonderful things. But then when we try to practice, something else creates a block. So there is always a block, a conflict between what we want to do sincerely and what our mind permits us to do, creating a block. If we can, if our mind will permit us to do what our intellect wants to do, then we can become saints overnight. Now, who is creating this mental block? Our own accumulated tendencies, impressions and vasanas, becoming a negative force, is catching you by the throat. That's the conflict between the secondary personality and the first personality, which professor was referring to. Difference today, as Jung refers to. That's why not when we start spiritual practice, as I mentioned, a secondary personality suddenly emerges, but it's very weak. Not only when you pray, You go to university, you read a wonderful book, a spiritual book. Suddenly some wonderful ideas come to your mind. So a strong desire to bring out a change, a total change in our attitude, lifestyle, everything. Because wonderful, if you read a book like, say, The Way of a Pilgrim, which is one of the most touching, moving books belonging to that category, which I have read several times, the Way of a Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. If you read a book like that, it takes maybe 3 hours to complete, mm-hmm. our French translation. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you feel, oh, the wonderful things. Mm-hmm. I shall start doing a new life tomorrow. You return your home, then you try to do a mental block. So you find the secondary personality, the higher personality is trying to emerge. But the early personality puts it down. So this conflict is the conflict between intellect and mind. What we want to do sincerely and what our mind permits us to do, which is very little. Okay, come.
Swami, you mentioned St. Paul the other day.
Yeah.
And that's, you've quoted that before, where he says, the evil that I would not, that I do. You know, the good that I would, I do not. That, you know, same thing.
Yeah.
And that old, he says, what is it that prevents me from doing what I would?
Yeah.
And he says it's the old man,
yeah.
which I just mm-hmm. got a thought that
yeah.
in the context of Vedanta, that's like from previous lives yeah, or
yeah.
whatever. It's that
yeah.
old thing
yeah.
you drag along.
Yeah. In fact, there'll be a few cases of patients suffering from depression who came to Vedanta Society. You who studied these books. So at least two cases I remember. They read Swamiji's lectures and tried to meditate, but the meditation became so complicated that the disturbance became much more acute. Mm-hmm. So I had to tell the person, please kindly do not meditate.
Yes.
You can pray.
Yes.
Prayer is a much less intense mm-hmm. in nature as a practice.
Yes.
But meditation could be disastrous for such people.
Yeah.
So this problem is always there.
Yeah.
People who get a rude shock through some tragic domestic events in their life, totally unbearable,
mm-hmm.
suddenly take to Vedanta or some mysticism or
yeah.
Christian mysticism, or prayer, whatever it is. But after some time, you know what happens? You reach a point of dead end. The reason is, you should keep feeding your mind with higher thoughts and higher ideas, then only the higher personality will grow higher and higher in stature. The first excitement, attraction, could help you to cultivate this higher personality. But it should be cultivated through constant reading and good life and what you call straightforwardness, all these qualities. Then this higher personality becomes higher and higher. Then you will have perfect tranquility and peace in mind. Otherwise, what happens when the higher personality becomes weaker and weaker, because the lower personality grows higher and higher because we are not able to continue spiritual practices. You wanted to ask something, please?
When you talked about the 6 epistemological frameworks, you said that there are 8 or 10, and you described one extra one that Vedanta doesn't accept.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could explain what some of the other ones are and why Vedanta doesn't accept
them. Yeah, yeah. Yes, asambhava, aitihya, cheshta, all these are some of the other methods. No?
Mm-hmm.
Sambhava, you know, they, some philosophers like the those who follow the mythological books, you know, they consider common sense experiences as one set of pramana or epistemology tool. Then hearsay, some popular statements, popular views. Cheshta is an external symbol. So all these are actually included more or less in inference. So that's why I did not give much importance to this, you know. So sambhava, aitihya, cheshta, these are all included in inference. So that's why I did not pay much attention to this. 6 are fundamental. Okay. Yeah.
I have one question.
Yeah,
on the
please,
same
please.
6 tools you mentioned, I don't think I heard the agama in that. Because Patanjali in one of the sutras says, while describing one of the chitavrittis, pratyakshanman agama pramani,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then in the agam is the spiritual declaration, I mean the scriptural declarations, that should also be considered as
agama. Agama is another name for verbal testimony, shabda pramana.
Oh, okay.
So agama is nothing but shabda pramana, which is already included in the six pramanas. You know? Agama is shabda pramana.
It's included in the shabda.
Yeah.
So, but
agama means shabda.
Yes.
Of course, yeah.
Okay. Which vritti is that? The pratyaksha man agama pramanani.
Yeah.
Which is that vritti that is describing?
Which one?
The Patanjali Yoga Sutra.
Yeah.
Pratyaksha man agama pramanani.
Yeah.
Last word I am from not getting.
Pratyaksha agama.
No, pratyaksha anuman agama pramanani. The last word describes, talks about the one of the chittavrittis, five chittavrittis. I forget that.
Five chittavrittis, you know, that yoga philosophy says, you know, pramana, vipirya, vikalpa, nidra, smritaya. These are five chittavrittis. That's not within our present, but I can give, since you asked, I can give in brief. The chittavrittis produced by these pramanas, and also pramana, vikalpa, vikalpa, vipariya, nidra, smritaya. So, words without a corresponding reality and false cognition, sleep, actually I mean dreams are meant here, and memory. These are other sources of vrittis, which are not within our subject here. Okay? Yeah, that belongs to Yoga Shastra. So, I have explained this in the yoga classes.
Okay.
When
you started today's talk, you mentioned two types of evolution.
Yeah.
One at the sadhaka level.
Yeah.
And the other at the concept of God.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about concept of God,
yeah,
it reminded me of when Sri Rama asks Hanuman,
yeah,
what do you think of me?
Yeah.
You know, he gives that answer where he says, if I see as separate from you,
Deva.
Yeah.
And then when I see as an amsha of you,
yeah,
and then when I see that we are both one.
Yeah, really, these are dvaita, visishta, dvaita, dvaita. When there is a distinction, I look upon me as a servant of God. When I'm part, like, you know, that is amshamsi tradition of visishta, dvaita, I'm part, you are the whole. And in advaita, we are one. See, so three levels of evolution. Any more? Any from anywhere?
So, it's clear in talking about this, the Mandukya Upanishad and Gaudapada Sakarika, that Sri Ramakrishna and Swamiji, at least if they were aware of this, were aware of Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. And I was wondering,
could you repeat this statement once more?
So in the Karika, there's a lot of discussion about Shunyavada and Vijnanavada, and
yeah,
I was wondering if there are places where Sri Ramakrishna or Swamiji talk more about those aspects of Buddhist philosophy, or if it's not discussed. Because, I mean, they're very universal,
yeah,
in how they discuss religion,
yeah,
and they talk about,
yeah,
Islam, and they talk about Christianity,
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if there are places where they talk more about these philosophical systems, or if they don't, because they're relatively inconsistent.
Yeah, you know, Swamiji and Sri Ramakrishna do not deal with the Buddhist philosophical systems as separate and different, totally different from Vedanta tradition. There is a historical reason for it. We don't. Because Vedanta observed all these four schools of later Buddhism. The two schools of realism, Sautrantika and Vaibhashika, the two schools of idealism, Vijnanavada and Shunyavada. It's called Yogacara and Shunyavada. So in India, what happened, you know, these schools of philosophy, these philosophical schools were very elaborately studied and taught, but they did not become a distinct and totally different path as it became in China, Japan, Korea,
yeah,
Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, and other countries.
Yeah.
So, what happened, you know, Swamiji and Sri Ramakrishna, at least Sri Ramakrishna very rarely deals with, almost never deals with Buddhist philosophy as a whole. He talks about Buddha as a great spiritual person. Swamiji also more or less. But, and then Swamiji is only referring to the humanistic aspect of Buddha, the great Buddhist, the great heart of Buddha, and how Buddha repudiated some of the dry rituals of Vedic tradition that he criticized, that he admires. And Swamiji very rarely deals with these four schools of Buddhism, almost never. He deals with Shunyavada and Vijnanavada, but I don't think he deals with Sautrantra and Vaibhashika. Never. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I missed that thing you were talking about. Aurobindo,
I will tell you. I tell you. I'm very happy that you raised the point. I also did not understand the importance of this statement. As of course, this is a personal matter. One of our teachers, who was from Calcutta, who lived close to Alipur, was a great scholar, was the one who pointed out this. Because I as a professor of English literature, we had to study Savitri. This is what is called Indian English literature. Savitri is a very famous book. So now, a lot of attraction for that. Because Aurobindo's writing is highly involved, sentences of some kind of pomposity. Then he said, because I was a Sanskritist and familiar with Shankara's tradition, he said that Aurobindo's concept of evolution, the evolution from matter to life and Superman, it is nothing but an evolution of sadhana chaturshtay sampatti that he mentioned. Again, he mentioned there is a statement that Aurobindo made, which is Shankara's Brahman is inactive like a stone. Like a stone.
Like a stone.
Of course, I don't make this statement because really it can lead to controversy. I may be even accused of taking it out of context. But Aurobindo's philosophy, there are many other aspects. So it is in a way a total deviation from the main teachings of Vedanta. Because like avyavaharyam, for example, you know how it is translated? Actionless, inactive. You read anywhere? Avyavaharyam, this mantra, all translations, actionless or inactive. What it means is, something that goes beyond even the idea of action-inaction equation. Because action-inaction equation apply only at the empirical level. We function, we walk, we attain things only at the empirical level. Atman is beyond, it transcends the very concept of action and the very concept of inaction and the very concept of its combination or the very concept of its absence. That's what it means. So, see, this denial of three, four aspects. Its presence is denied, its absence is denied, its combination is denied, and the absence of the combination also is denied. Now, where do you get this interpretation? From the commentary. If you read the Upanishad, that's the main problem. You have to remember, these Upanishad mantras, before Shankaracharya touched these mantras with this magical hand, these Upanishad mantras did not have this profound meaning that today we understand. In Vedic hermeneutics, Upanishad mantras, Vedanta mantras, Vijnanakanda mantras got its high metaphysical meaning and interpretation from Shankaracharya for the first time. The other commented was Sayana, who came 450 years after Shankaracharya. And wherever Sayana refers to Upanishad mantras, which are already being explained by Shankaracharya, he just repeats, copies down, same, because he was a follower of Shankaracharya. There are other commentaries, which are only some portions, One, the earliest commentary of Vedic mantras belongs to Yaska, 7th or 8th century BC. But he refers to only, let us say, if you can put the whole Vedas in about 20 pages, that much only he asks us Nirukta. Words are taken, Indra, Varuna, all these words are taken. Deva, Devodanava, Divanava, Dyodanava, Dusthanava, Bhavati, like a thesaurus dictionary. So it takes one word Deva and gives four meanings. That's what Vyaska did. But these Upanishad mantras were taken from the Vedas and gave a philosophical meaning which the whole world admires today, was a genius of Shankaracharya. That's the point. That's why Avyavaharin, that's a main problem in studying the Upanishad. The word Avyavaharin is used. It literally means that which is not involved in any action, any activity. So simple pronunciation will be inactive or actionless, which is actually, which is nothing compared to the real implication of the word. Transcending action-inaction equation. Because action-inaction refer to life and experiences of the empirical plane. This Atma is transcendental reality. So this Vyavahara, action-inaction equation, doesn't apply there. That's what I mean. Okay, it's clear to you? Okay, so we'll continue the discussion in the next class. Thank you.
Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om, that's it. Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.